By downloading or listening to this podcast, you are agreeing to Moody's legal terms and conditions found at moodys.com/disclaimer, including that the information provided is not investment or financial advice, and that Moody's will not be liable for losses arising from your use of the information.
I'm Danielle Reed, and this is Moody's Talks, Focus on Finance. In today's episode, part two in our coverage of the benefits and risks of private credit, I'll be talking with Neil Epstein of the asset management team about growth in private credit assets, how that's benefited asset managers, and broader risks this growth poses. Then later, my co-host Michael Porta will talk to Warren Kornfeld of the banking and finance companies team about non-bank lenders' expanding share of corporate lending. Non-bank lenders include CLOs, hedge funds, private funds, and business development companies, or BDCs. And Michael will also zero in on BDCs' performance in an inflationary environment when he talks to Clay Montgomery of the banking and finance companies team. Michael, hi. Welcome back.
Hi, Danielle. Yeah, that's right. The rapid growth of private credit is expanding opportunity and risk for financial institutions. And with that, the ground we have to cover, along with Warren and Clay.
And now to non-bank lenders. What's happening in the corporate lending space?
Well, their share of corporate lending is growing again. Since a 2012 trough following tight liquidity post the global financial crisis, non-bank share of corporate lending has grown steadily to around 63% of the $3.1 trillion market, and that's at year-end 2021. Though I should note that excludes still outstanding pandemic-related corporate loans that the Federal Reserve and U.S. government agencies issued. Those equaled about $300 billion at that date.
And so why are the non-bank lenders growing their share of corporate loans?
There's a couple of main reasons. The first is that there's been a lot of investor demand for higher yielding investments because, as you know, until very recently, we were in a prolonged low interest rate environment. So a lot of hunger for yield out there. Also, over the past decade, banks have pulled back from lending to the most leveraged borrowers. This is a trend that's been encouraged by regulatory developments, including stress testing, as well as more explicit leverage lending guidelines for banks. So banks left a void that non-banks are happy to fill. But should note that banks remain a primary source of funding for smaller non-corporate businesses like sole proprietorships, partnerships, and LLCs.
Right. So investors are seeking higher yields, and that means they might be more willing to assume higher credit and illiquidity risk. And the BDCs, which Clay covers, are among the main non-bank lenders to more highly leveraged middle market companies, right?
That's right. And Clay will share his view of their performance in the present inflationary environment.
Thanks, Michael. We'll hear more about non-bank lenders and BDCs in particular in a few minutes. But first, Neil Epstein of the asset management team is joining to talk to us about how growth in private credit assets has benefited asset managers, and also what some of the broader risks are from that growth in private credit. Neil, welcome back to Focus on Finance.
Hi, Danielle. Thanks for having me.
So, Neil, your report looks at private credit, the lending side of the private markets, and how growth in private credit funds has been a positive story for asset managers. To start with, what's been driving the growth in private credit funds?
Sure. Private credit has been linked inextricably to the growth in private equity funds. And they have, as you probably know, over the last 10 years, experienced significant growth. In particular, the leverage buyout funds, which are a subclass of private equity, are heavy users of debt because in undertaking a leverage buyout, you're typically borrowing a lot of the value of the acquired firm. Historically, that borrowing took place in the syndicated bank loan market, but over the years, private credit funds who focus in this asset class have become lenders as well to private equity firms. And so the two asset classes have really grown in tandem.
So, Neil, you mentioned leverage. You said that they do a lot of borrowing. How much leverage are you talking about for these private equity funds?
Private equity deals typically use 55% of a deal's purchase price. That's been an average in undertaking a buyout. And the deals themselves have become significantly leveraged with multiples, in some cases, 12 times EBITDA. So we're often talking about leverage levels in these deals that can be 7 times, which is extremely leveraged for a credit issuer.
Okay. And what is it that is so attractive about private credit for asset managers? I mean, what are the specific benefits?
Well, as with other private fund investments, the fund manager is raising funds in a long-term committed format. So when an investor signs on to invest with a fund, it commits capital for long periods of time, up to a decade. And so for the asset manager, it knows that it has available capital to be called on demand. And that stability is very, very helpful because it means that the asset manager can time its investments and be opportunistic in terms of entering into favorable situations that it uncovers over time. In addition, of course, these funds are usually structured around a performance fee framework, which are very lucrative to the asset manager. So the asset manager will be paid depending on the degree of excess return that the fund will deliver.
So I can see that the fees would be a big motivator too. But who's doing all this lending in private credit?
So lenders really cover a wide variety of firms. The broadly diversified alternative asset managers that were traditionally most identified with private equity have diversified into credit. A lot of the situations that are being financed, which are often, again, private equity sponsored LBOs, are situations that they are naturally, culturally strong at analyzing and whose dynamics they understand. But alongside them, there are specialist firms in credit. Some have grown quite big. Some have become independent originators of lending situations. So you can think of names like HPS, Investment Partners. You know, Ares is a very important lender, Golub Capital and Antares. And then Wall Street firms, which have their own asset management arms, and of course have also been involved in transactions like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, have also been sponsors of private credit funds.
So that's a pretty broad appeal when you name all those different types of firms. But nonetheless, there are some significant risks that arise from the growth of private credit, and you talk about those in your report. Could you explain a little about what those are?
Sure. First of all, since we're talking about leveraged buyout transactions generally, which have, as I said, high multiples, these firms also typically are somewhat smaller. If they were bigger, stronger borrowers, they might be using the bank syndicated loan market. But here we're talking about firms that are clearly spec grade rated, would be spec grade rated, as private firms are typically not getting ratings. So we see them, you know, as riskier businesses at the get-go. And firms like this in an economic downturn would be especially exposed to risk because they have smaller footprints and less economic depth to survive a weaker economy, such as we're facing right now. Of course, right now, markets are facing a lot of risks from inflation arising from the military conflict in Ukraine. Globally, there have been supply disruptions stemming from COVID. So we see this leveraged sector as being under more stress right now.
And then, you know, there are some things that can be done to mitigate this risk that you've just enumerated here. What are some of those mitigants?
Well, first of all, private credit firms are working with locked up capital, which means that if there are stress situations where it might make sense to modify loans, provide additional capital that can support a borrower through a stress period. Since typically the lenders in the private space are a more concentrated group, you might have one or two lenders providing all the debt as opposed to a syndicated bank market where you have a larger group. They're able to maintain stronger communication they're able to respond more rapidly and more focused to stress situations. And in fact, many of these lenders maintain specialists who work out distress loans. The outcomes are likely to be variable depending on a lot of factors, but lenders' credit culture is key, and some of these lenders have a very strong culture of credit analysis, and they are able to work rapidly and flexibly to help manage through stress situations.
Neil, thank you so much. And we're now joined by Michael Porta, here to talk to Warren Kornfeld and Clay Montgomery of the banking team about non-bank lenders' growing presence in corporate lending and about how business development companies in particular are likely to fare in today's inflationary environment.
Thank you, Danielle. Warren and Clay, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Michael. Nice to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Warren, we'll start with you for the broader view of non-bank lenders' growing share of corporate lending, with banks ceding share in this space. How much of this market now belongs to the non-bank lenders? And beyond that, what's driving the shift?
So, Michael, let's first just talk about the data, as data to track these sectors can be a little bit difficult to get. So the data set that we used was the Federal Reserve's quarterly Z1 flow of funds and balance sheet accounts report as of year-end 2021. Now, the Z1 report breaks down commercial lending into three buckets: loans to corporations, loans to non-corporates such as LLCs, sole proprietorships, partnerships, as well as corporate debt. We're going to focus here just on that corporate lending. So in this corporate lending market, from 1999 to Q3 2010, the non-bank lender's share grew very rapidly, going from about 42% at the end of 1999 to 67% as of the peak in Q3 2010. Then post the financial crisis, as everybody's well aware, tight funding availability, particularly for non-banks, caused the non-bank share to decline from that 67% to 51% by year-end 2012. After that bottom, the non-bank share of corporate lending began this new steady climb, which, as we've seen, has been accelerating over the last 2 years. And as of year-end 2021, the share was equal to around 63%.
Okay, so we're almost back to 2010 levels in this $3.1 trillion market. And again, just for listeners' benefit, we're talking about loans to corporations here. So what's driving this renewed growth of non-bank lenders' share in that space?
So a lot of it has been driven by low rates and by investors hunting for yield. These non-bank lenders, you know, are willing to assume greater, you know, credit and illiquidity risk to get that yield. So they're turning to investment vehicles such as business development companies, which are also known as BDCs, collateralized loan obligations or CLOs, as well as private credit funds. In addition, over the past year, investors have been looking for floating rate investments, and this with rising, you know, interest rates, and this has also increased the appeal for investing in corporate lending. And then the final element is that over the last decade or so, banks have also retreated to a certain extent from the riskier lending segments, including lending to some of the most leveraged firms, a trend that was reinforced by regulatory stress testing, as well as more explicit Federal Reserve lending, leveraged lending guidelines introduced in 2013.
Right. So in combination with the non-banks going after more share because investors are searching for yield, banks have also been receding from this space for the reasons you outlined, including tougher leveraged lending guidelines. So within this total market share of non-bank lenders, what's the subdivision? You mentioned BDCs, CLOs, hedge funds. What's the split there?
So in our grouping, CLOs have been growing, you know, particularly fast over the last couple of years, and they now command a 29% share of this, you know, that $3.1 trillion corporate lending market. Private credit funds are next. That includes, you know, hedge funds, And that private credit funds are now at 14%. And then, you know, combined, you know, these two segments, you know, are at 43%, which exceeds the bank's share at 37%. Next, you know, business development companies, as you've mentioned, have also been, you know, growing, you know, pretty fast. However, they're part of the finance company segment, and traditional finance companies have seen a decrease, at, you know, a very material decline. And now that the overall finance company share is just 9%.
Okay. So BDC is growing, but finance companies overall have a declining share. And finally, before we bring Clay on to tell us more about BDCs in particular, you cover some of the risks of this growth of non-bank lending in your report. What are the key ones that you see?
So the thing, you know, is this rapid expansion of private credit, you know, has driven increased corporate leverage, has been supportive of increasing corporate leverage as the non-banks, as I mentioned, have this higher risk appetite than banks do. And, you know, the non-banks are not subject to the same level of regulatory oversight and disclosure as banks are. We see the potential for there is opacity as to exactly what's happening, as well as potentially systemic risk, some of which Neil, you know, addressed earlier.
Warren, thank you for that very helpful overview of the non-bank lenders' growth. And now we'll switch over to Clay. Clay, you took a deeper dive into BDC performance, specifically in the context of higher inflation. So what are we seeing for BDCs in this environment?
So there's good news and bad news for BDCs. BDCs largely have floating rate debt-oriented investment portfolios and have increased the amount of fixed rate debt liabilities in their capital structures over the last few years. So as rates go up, their portfolios are set to generate more interest income and their interest costs won't keep pace. That benefit in an additional 200 basis point rate increase scenario is as much as 25% to net interest income pre-incentive fees versus Q1 levels. So that's the good news. The bad news is that portfolio companies that BDCs lend to will have to contend with higher interest costs from higher rates, as well as higher expenses from inflationary pressures. Where things ultimately end up will depend on the path that the economy eventually takes and an individual BDC's ability to manage through a tougher credit environment.
Another benefit that you mentioned in your report for BDCs is that their funding appears to have been improved. You talk about how most have opportunistically shifted to fixed rate unsecured debt, which is helping fix their interest costs. Could you explain that in a little more detail?
Sure. So 2021 was a great year for BDC unsecured debt issuance. It reflected nearly two times the amount that was done in 2020. And it was all done at very low costs relative to kind of historical norms. That access to unsecured debt capital transformed many BDCs' debt funding profiles. Not only did it free up bank funding capacity and lessen BDCs' reliance on bank facilities, but it also allowed BDCs to fix more of their interest costs. That in and of itself doesn't generate any income for BDCs, but it does limit the upward pull to expenses in a rising rate environment since unsecured is fixed rate. And that ultimately supports our favorable outlook for core profitability for the BDCs.
So two big things working in the BDC's favor when it comes to profitability. One is rising interest income because of their floating rate portfolios. And in the meantime, they're fixing more of their interest costs, so those won't rise. But there are also some risks in the inflationary environment for the BDCs. What are the main ones you would highlight?
Sure. So BDC's whole business model is built around lending to smaller middle market companies, which we think are more vulnerable to business stresses, whether due to kind of inflationary cost pressures or higher interest rates relative to, you know, larger, more creditworthy companies. They're also leveraged quite a bit because most of the portfolio companies are sponsor backed and generally fall outside what a bank is willing to lend to. You know, generally on average, BDC's portfolio companies have 2 to 3 times interest coverage levels. So we think that given the profile of BDC's loans, that does leave them vulnerable to some deterioration in asset quality in a more challenging environment where interest costs are going up and interest coverage is weakening. And also some portfolio companies might be feeling pressure from inflation or having supply chain issues. That said, in our base case, we only expect an incremental increase in problem loans, more of a normalization from where things stood at the back half of last year and earlier this year, with non-accruals at very low, benign levels. However, we think downside risks outside of our base case have also increased. And in a more severe scenario involving a recession, obviously the stresses would be even more pronounced. Non-accruals will turn higher, and you'll also see asset coverage ratios decline.
Are there any specific factors, Clay, that will help mitigate a more adverse economic environment for BDCs?
Sure. First off, BDCs are starting out in a very solid position. Their portfolios are marked near cost or even slightly above cost. Non-accruals at Q1 were lower than levels seen pre-COVID. Payment in kind interest has come down across the sector, and the pressures in general that built up during peak COVID times have eased quite a bit to get BDCs back on good footing. I'd also mention again that, you know, our base case is for slowing economic growth, not recession. So while we think that type of backdrop may increase pressures on asset quality, we expect them to be moderate and not severe. And lastly, I just mentioned that BDCs have operated in a elevated rate environment before. So in 2016 to 2019, reference rates rose well above loan floor levels, and they had limited issues from those rising reference rates. Interest coverage deteriorated, but we did not see a spike in non-accruals at the same time. The environment now is not a perfect mirror image of back then, but I still think it's a good incremental data point to consider.
Got it. So, yeah, you know, the past doesn't necessarily predict the future, but it is a reference point. Clay, Warren, Michael, and Neil, thank you all so very much for your insights. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. To read any of the reports referenced in this episode, you can click the link for today's episode at about.moodys.io/podcasts. And if you're listening to this podcast on a streaming service, please remember to follow or subscribe. And please join us again for future episodes of Focus on Finance.
Thanks for listening to this Moody's Talks podcast. To find out more about the topics discussed, please follow the links in the show notes. You can check out other Moody's Talks podcasts by visiting moodys.com/podcasts.